She was at death's door, but when she opened her eyes and saw the bright, hairy head of the lion staring into her face, she did not scream or faint. She said, "Oh, Aslan, I knew it was true. I've been waiting for this all my life. Have you come to take me away?"
Probably one of the funniest scenes in the series, Glizelle and Cepespion. Outwardly begging him not to accept it, but inwardly we know they're trying to get him to accept it.
Which, I always loved that scene. I don't know, for some reason, it was incredibly memorable to me, and I always thought, how interesting. It just kind of added a new dynamic of politics that just made it a little more interesting with, oh yes, it's not just the good and the bad, it's like the, you know, good, the bad, the ugly, and the villainous, you
with,
know what I
with
mean?
Two characters just kind of coming out of nowhere, Glizelle and Cepespion, were given very little time to be introduced to them, but they're automatically kind of appealing characters and really funny just because of what they're trying to do and the way they're trying to do it.
I mean, this story adds a new aspect to Narnia, where before in The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, you have like the good magic and the bad magic, you know, kind of a classic fairy tale story. This has the good magic and the secular. Both were forces of evil, even though one is sort of anti-magic, anti-fairy tale, anti-fantasy, and the other isn't, you know. And it's kind of humorous to me at the same time. I always thought it was kind of a funny scene how Miraz is so prideful and so diehard to...
I love the fact that like they know Miraz so well.
They know he'll fall.
They know exactly how to push his buttons. They know exactly how to get him to do what they want him to do. And I love their idea of it makes sense. They say, you know, if Miraz defeats Peter, well then good, we've won the war. But if he loses, well, Miraz is no very great captain. That's probably a good thing for us anyway. And of course, they're assuming we're not going to honor the agreement. We're just going to whip out the old Narnians, even if they win. And I love after he accepts it. I love the part where there's another memorable little funny moment. Against all odds, after all these years, for some reason, the Bulgy Bear remembers it was always a right of the bear to supply one marshal of the lists, and so they're forced to have him be one of them, even though they obviously don't want to because he'll suck his paws. That seems to be one of those little funny moments everyone remembers. And then Reepicheep wanting to fight as well is very memorable.
Exactly. Yeah, and this actually is possibly one of my favorite scenes with Peter. You know, Reepicheep is the one who, you know, he wants to, I'm just reading it here, he says, "I have among my people the only trumpeter in your majesty's army. I had thought perhaps we might have been sent with the challenge, sire. My people are grieved. Perhaps if it were your pleasure that I should be a marshal of the lists, it would content them." And, you know, Peter basically says, you know, "I'm afraid it wouldn't do. Some humans are afraid of mice." And he allows Reepicheep to keep his honor, to not be embarrassed at all, even though, of course, to everyone else it's just ridiculous.
Right.
And, you know, Peter is so understanding because he respects Reepicheep. And, of course, he answers in a way that Reepicheep would respect.
And I think he takes Reepicheep seriously, but he knows that the enemy won't.
Right.
And so...
Yeah, well, and he takes Reepicheep's honor seriously. He doesn't just make fun of Reepicheep because Reepicheep takes himself so seriously, you know.
Right. The thing I remember most about this fight, I think, is the fact that it's told from the point of view of the spectators. It's Dr. Cornelius and it's, you know, Edmund and Trumpkin and all of them reacting to it. Like, "What was it? My old eyes missed it." You know, like, "The High King has pricked him in the arm. First blood." You know, it's like Lewis says, it was like the moment before the battle starts. It was like the moment before the pistol goes at an important race, but very much worse. And there's something about showing it from the point of view of the people who care about Peter, about the people who have a stake in this. You know, if Peter wins, maybe they can take Narnia back. If he loses, then they're all slaves or maybe dead. Even the movie, it kind of takes the more conventional approach of telling it pretty much from Peter's point of view. And you've got a light on your face.
I was just trying it out, this little light that hooks into a USB, but I thought, no, that's not going to work.
That's really weird.
It only lights up one part of my face, and I look creepy, so that's the end of it.
Okay. But, so I was talking about the point of view of the spectators. I think it really adds a lot to it, and it's a surprising perspective. It's not the obvious way of writing
it. It doesn't really get you inside the fighters' heads, which in some ways I think keeps it more suspenseful.
That almost makes it more tense,
yeah.
Because we're just watching. We don't exactly – and there are times where they can't exactly tell what's going on.
Yeah, you don't know if Peter's arm is broken or if it's dislocated or what's
going on. I wonder if it just even maybe puts the little tiniest seed in your head that maybe Peter could die or be seriously hurt, because we're not seeing it from his point of view. If it's from his point of view, it seems much less likely that he's going to die. But now that we're kind of emotionally distant from Peter, we don't know what he's thinking, we don't know what he's going through, that seems like a more likely possibility. So I really like the perspective Lewis takes on this.
And then we have, well, we could comment on Peter's chivalry again, deciding to not kill Miraz when he's down.
That's Peter's true power. It's not that he's such a great sword fighter. It's that the values he brings from the old days. Yeah. That's really why Narnia needs him back.
It is ironic, though, because it's Peter's honor and chivalry that does allow for Miraz to be killed, because that's when Glazell's Thespian run up.
It's interesting, you know, we know that Thespian gets his head cut off. Peter cuts off his head. We never find out, or wallops off his head, as Lewis puts it, but we never find out what happened to Glazell. He just sort of...
He just becomes unimportant.
But Glazell stopped to stab his own king dead where he lay. That's for your insult this morning, he whispered as the blade went home. And that's... I'm pretty sure that's the last we ever hear of Glazell.
Yeah. And then, of course, we have... The fights come together. You have centaurs charging. You have the dwarves shooting. You have
the mice charging.
And then, of course, you have the great line that I wish they could have put in the movie: "Come back, Ruby Jeep, you little ass." That would have been awesome.
There's been a couple of times in the story now where, you know, the mice have, you know, they weren't able to be marshal of the list. They weren't able to go with the challenge, and there's been people kind of underestimating them. I'm sure they're used to this. So it's great for them to have their moment, followed by the return of the trees, or as the Telmarines call it, the wood, the end of the world.
Yeah.
The audio drama did a great job on that, I thought.
Tough-looking warriors turned white, gazing in terror behind them, and then flung down their weapons, shrieking,
"The wood!
Yeah.
And you can just imagine their terror, especially the Telmarines, who would have always imagined the trees were full of ghosts and were always suspicious and, you know, not trusting of the trees. And then the Telmarines, just to add to their terror, they come to the bridge, they don't come to the bridge. They come to where the bridge should be, and it's gone. And it's here that for the second time in the story, we have a major... it's not as major as the first one. The first one, we went back, you know, years. This one, we're just going back, you know, maybe a few hours. But this is another, I think, kind of weak point in the story. So much energy with the battle with Peter and Miraz, and now the trees, and then the bridge is gone, which is a great moment. Like, how did it happen? Well, let's go back in time, and then we kind of cut away from it. I don't know how it would have worked if he would have done cutting back and forth and telling it chronologically, because like the build up and the way the build up to the fight is. It's paced so well. I don't know. And when would you have started all the bits of them, you know, running through town and you know, turning the guy into a tree and turning the boys into pigs? And you know, where are you going to intercut the fight with that stuff? You know, that stuff we're not going to work because all the tension's gone. We're going from tension to happy. So I think
that's the problem, is the tension, because it does feel kind of odd. It's just sort of like, well, now we must, you know, go back to the girls.
Uh-huh.
I almost wonder, what if he were to have the bridge being gone, surrender, maybe even the moment with Reepy Cheep, just to kind of tone it down a little bit, start to change the mood, and then go back in time?
You think it would it be a good idea to go that long without knowing what happened to the bridge? Would there be no explanation for? Because that's basically the thing that wins the battle. So it does seem like you do have to address it. I guess my issue is that. The first flashback with Trumpkin telling the story of Caspian is somewhat motivated. It's the kids asking all these questions, and he's like, look, okay, I'm just going to have to explain everything to you, so I'm going to tell you a story. And in this one, this is just Lewis kind of going, okay, let's go back now. So although, you know, like the other cut, eventually you get into it, and it's interesting. Initially, it kind of takes the wind out of the sails of the book.
I think it does feel weird. I'll admit that. I think that... it would have been great if he could have brought the tone, the intensity down a bit before going to the girls. Maybe start to transition from an intense battle theme to getting the reader ready for a more light transition. But I don't know how exactly it would have done.
Or maybe what if they had just had, like, Lucy and Susan explain what happened? Like, you know, run up to Peter after the battle and go, oh my gosh, yesterday Aslan did this and that. And, kind of like what happened at the end of the first Battle of Bruin, where they get there and then you have, you know, Peter saying, oh, is all Edmund's doing? And he explains what happened at the end of the battle, how the witch lost her wand. So it was sort of maybe a mirror of that a little bit.
I don't know, because frankly, I never really liked the recounting of the first Battle of Bruna.
Oh, okay.
It's like, bullet point, here's the cliff notes. I think some of the humor would have been lost. I'm just trying to imagine here. I don't think it'd be as funny to hear Susan Lucy say, oh, and he turned this one man into a tree, and all these little nasty boys got turned into pigs.
Yeah,
I don't think that would have really...
You're right.
That wouldn't have really come across as humorous. I think you're actually right. Be humorous where you're reading in... Oh my goodness, he really did that.
Yeah, it's kind of like, which, I mean, that's one of the most, that's another fairly divisive scene. I think there are some fans who are just like, it's so crazy, I love it. And so other fans who are like, I don't know, it's so crazy, I don't think I like it. And
I'm going to say, it's so crazy, I love it. I love that he turned the guy into a tree. I love all that stuff.
It's like the absolute, after such a, you know, fairly dark story. And it's so kind of a fairly grounded story in terms of magic, I think, relatively speaking. What's happened so far, and then it's just like all hell breaks loose at the very end, and it gets crazy.
It would not have worked to have intercut it with the battle. Just
no
throwing that. I just decided no.
No, it wouldn't have, and I'm sure it's probably something Lewis considered, and just the going through the process right now, I think it's probably pretty clear why he didn't go that direction.
yeah.
But it's a great scene. They're going through, and you know, the group gets bigger and bigger, and we're seeing the Telmarine people gladly and willingly siding with Aslan. And this is probably something they've been wanting for a long time, I think, is the sense you get.
But even at the beginning, where it talks about, you know, Caspian's a young boy, and then he starts growing up, and it says he learned that the people were unhappy under Miraz. The taxes were high, the people were oppressed, and you know, I know... Monty Python, he's suppressing me. The Telmarines want this too. They want the redemption. They may not know what it looks like, but they want the redemption too.
It's such a great, there's just so many great, I think it's just an image of emotionally what's happening here, of the boy getting beaten, and then, you know, 1 second he's crying, then a minute later he's laughing. And then all the kids getting turned into pigs, and it's kind of like, yeah, like you said, like, did that just happen? Did they really do that? But to me, there's this fairy tale kind of poetic justice to it. And then really, after a little bit of sort of fun, we get to a really serious bit, which is Aslan healing the nurse, who we don't know as nurse immediately.
Well, and that was something that I was kind of hitting on earlier, where if Lucy and Susan just told the story in retrospect, you can't have the character describe something as well like that. I love the line, oh, Aslan, I knew it was true. I have been waiting for this all my life. Have you come to take me away? Yes, dearest, but not the long journey yet.
Oh,
it offers such a great moment. Picture of the healing and the redemption. And on one hand, you know, I know some people were really upset that Bacchus was gone from the film and that he wasn't there. And yes, I admit Bacchus has a lot of meaning and symbolism Bacchus provides that, you know, you wouldn't really have otherwise. However, me personally, I would have rather had something like this. I would have rather seen a picture of a real person who has suffered and has now been waiting for this and finally receives the reward for her patience.
And it's a really emotional scene. Someone a few months ago pointed something out to me in the forum. It was Narni Weber, the Lady Arwen Omdomniel. That's how you say it.
Omdomniel.
Pointed out to me, and I cannot fathom why I didn't... I guess I noticed it, but I just never really thought about the implications of it. I guess I'm just so caught up in the emotion of the moment. I don't notice. It's like the big reveal here that Lewis writes that she looked as if she had dwarf blood in her.
Yeah.
And I just never somehow... I mean, the implication, I guess, is that... So she's part dwarf, and she's had... Like, the fact that Caspian had a nurse who was part dwarf... And then he's replaced by Cornelius, who's part dwarf.
Yeah.
So something must have been going on there, something intentional. Like, I feel like it couldn't just be a coincidence. She must have known Cornelius, and they were planning this and somehow arranged it. And it just implies this whole, maybe they've been trying to do this for a while. Maybe they've been trying to get to Caspian and tell him stories for, maybe it's been years and years they've been trying to get this done for all we know. To me, it just... And she says, I've been wanting this all my life. Like, and maybe they've been desperately trying to make Caspian a better king. It just, just that line, like, she had some dwarf blood in here in her. I don't know why I didn't suggest the implications of that, but that just suggests so much more, like, off-screen backstory of what was going on even before, you know, the story picks up with Caspian. Wonderful emotional beat when, you know, I've been waiting for this all my life. She's healed and then being reunited with Caspian. Or we didn't know it. We don't know it's Caspian's nurse until that moment.
No, we don't. And I'll never forget when I was first being read the story as a small boy. I remember going, oh my goodness, he gets to have his nurse. His nurse reunited.
Everything is restored.
Yeah, and which you don't even predict that. You just think, oh, nurse.
She's so off your radar completely at this point.
Yeah, whatever.
And, of course, another thing that gets restored here is Reepicheep's tail. We have the mice carrying Reepicheep. And that's another kind of favorite moment, I think, among fans, is him getting his tail back.
Yeah, I love that. I love the little bit with Reepicheep. I mean, it's so...
And it's really, I think it actually carries some emotional weight here. In the movie, it's more, I mean, it's kind of like, oh, I hope he's not hurt. Reepicheep's a funny character, but it's still, like, people kind of chuckle at that scene. Even when he asks for his tail, then there's one shot of Lucy, then a shot of Aslan looking at each other, and they just seem to, as he's talking, and they just seem to be saying, oh, he's such a funny character. And whereas here, I think you really do kind of take it seriously. And it's kind of graphic, too, when it talks about all the little bits that Lucy had to put the cordial on.
And what I like about Reepicheep, I love... Reepicheep is one of the most honest characters in the whole... in all the Chronicles. He doesn't really care what people think. I mean, in a matter of being courteous, he does. But not to ever sacrifice honesty. And I just love... I love the line... Where your Aslan says, but what do you want with a tail? And he says, sir, I can eat and sleep and die for my king without one, but a tail is the honor and glory of a mouse.
The three, that's such a defining line. It's the three things that are essential to life. Eat, sleep, die for your king, that Reepicheep mentions. That's his character.
Yeah, and I love that. And he's being honest, saying, I don't need it for someone else. He's making a humble request, asking if anything can be done for his own sake, which is the honest way to ask, because if you're asking for something for yourself, you know, he's being honest about it.
Uh-huh.
And then, of course, you have this really neat little grand trivia point, I suppose you could say, where you find out about the mice that chewed the ropes that bound Aslan.
Another little bit, you did kind of like reunited with Nurse Solo on a bigger scale, you just don't see coming.
On one hand, Prince Caspian is... I'd say one of the weakest, but there's so many little lines here, like the line of Aslan and Lucy saying, where he says, every year that you grow, you will find me bigger. There's so many little bits of character development, little bits that reveal parts of who Aslan is, who these other characters are.
I wonder if maybe it's, of all the books in the series, it has more tiny little bits that you remember than the other ones. It's not so much the big scenes. It's that line line and that moment.
Because, like, even, like, look at, you know, this one page with Reepicheep and the mice, you know. It's not like it's even part of one big grand subplot of Reepicheep. He goes in the battle. He knew that. Okay, he comes out. He's wounded. He has his tail cut off. And you look at what Lewis does as far as character development for Aslan, for Reepicheep, in this one page worth. It's really... it's a testament to his great writing, and I think it's a part of why this book is still loved in the Chronicles. People still love this book, even if they say, it's not my favorite. But, you know, it's moments like this that make the book, memorable.
The Prince Caspian kind of ends on a bunch of little moments, kind of one after the other. Even sort of really weird bits, like, where it says that Lucy realized that the trees were going to eat Earth, it gave her rather a shudder. But when she saw the earths that were actually being brought to them, she felt quite different. They began with a rich brown loam that looked almost exactly like chocolate, so like chocolate, in fact, that Edmund tried a piece of it, and he did not find it nice at all. And there's just these weird, bunch of weird little bits of just sort of experiencing the fact that the old days are back, and me just getting a sense of what these days are going to be like. And I love the bit where, you know, they're just partying, the old days are back, and then it says... The best thing of all about this feast was that there was no breaking up or going away. But as the talk grew quieter and slower, one after another, one would begin to nod and finally drop off to sleep with feet towards the fire and good friends on either side. It's just, life is good.
With this redemption of Narnia, again, I love, you know, Lewis, one of the things that I think is the best way to describe it, when Lewis looks at life, he takes kind of a holistic approach. He doesn't split things into like what Francis Schaeffer would call the eminent and transcendent, or the secular and the physical things, and then the spiritual things, or the intangible things. You know, in Lewis's world, you have the fairy tale creatures and you have the humans. And life is just as real for both of them. They both experience the same emotions. They have the same. They both have the same weight in character development. You know, Lewis, he's not picking and choosing between the fairy tale creatures, so to speak, and the humans, because there is no distinction in Narnia.
I really love how I kind of talked about this. You know, the first half. About the reversal, where in Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, I think the emphasis is put on the children discovering this myth becoming real, which is Narnia, and it's reversed in Prince Caspian, of now the children are the myth being discovered. And I think you have a similar reversal here, where, you know, that another theme in Narnia is characters just sensing, I don't belong here, I belong somewhere else. Shasta is probably the best example of that. He just, somehow his whole life, he just knew he belonged somewhere else. And then when Aslan tells the Telmarines, you know, you didn't actually come from this world originally. You came from, you know, somewhere else. One guy says, there you are. I might have guessed we didn't belong to this place with all its queer, nasty, unnatural creatures. And so even the Telmarines knew, who were in Narnia, going, I don't belong here. It just, there's just something not right about this. So this whole notion of somehow in your blood, just in your bones, you just know, I don't belong here. I belong somewhere else. It's a theme that we'll be discussing again and again as we continue this series.
No, that's a great
and
point.
Then Peter and Susan not coming back.
Peter
can
and
you,
Susan.
Can you remember,
that
can
was
you remember
sad
your
for
reaction
me.
When you first read that?
Yeah, I thought, here's what was sad. Here, and maybe this is sort of a unique response. I've always loved Peter in some ways as my favorite character. And he was the character I most sought to emulate. I thought, okay, he's the eldest of four. I'm the eldest of three. I identified with Peter, and I thought, I want to be Peter. I want to do what Peter is doing. I want to be in this story. I want to be in Peter's shoes. And then, oh my goodness, you know, here's my desire of wanting to be in Peter's shoes. And then Peter is told he can't come back to Narnia. And gave me some thoughts on just, you know, responsibility and growing up, and life's not all fun and games and play. But at the same time, I had this thought of, well, why is it that, because Aslan is obviously doing the right thing. I mean, I was a child. I just took it for granted. And I think that because of who Aslan is, it's not like it's some magical device in the story of, here's this world children go into from our world, and then when they reach this certain age, they can't go anymore.
Right.
No, it's actually, well, they could, but he's not letting them. That's what makes it interesting.
I think initially, I kind of have a bad taste in my mouth from this scene. Like, when I first read it, not quite knowing how Lewis was gonna, like, here he just said, you know, he says we're getting too old, and then at the end of Don Treader, he'll explain that a lot more, like what that really means. It doesn't really just mean they're getting too old. It's actually more than that. But initially, that does seem kind of weak to me. It's like in a story about finally coming home, we're finally back. No, just kidding. You're going home.
yeah.
Your reason is because you're too old. And to me, it's sort of a in a sense, it feels fulfilling because, okay, this character's come a long way, and now this is the end of his journey. It's going to end on a really emotional note. Makes sense, but it's same as just, because you're getting too old, that's it? It just kind of leaves me emotionally hanging a bit. And then I think Aslan's explanation in Dawn Treader, and then, but most especially, the last half of Last Battle really makes me look at the scene in a different light. But, you know, we'll get to that eventually.
Yeah. Someday, yeah. I'll have a few kids, and, you know, if I
can. Yeah, we'll get to the end of this series.
By the time.
But I love how, you know, there's so much seriousness at the end of this book. You know, it's so emotional of, you know, the children seem to be seeing, you know, three things at once, and then, you know, Peter's saying, we have had a time. And it's just really like, wow, you've just gone on an emotional journey, and Peter and Susan not coming back. But then how does Lewis end it? Father said, Edmund, I left my new torch in Narnia. And it's just like, oh yeah, the torch. And it's just, I think it's a great way. Like, I think if any other author did that, I think it would come across as a cheat. Like, you just had to find a way to throw in a joke in there to, you know, break up the tension a bit. But it really works here.
Well, here's the way I like about Lewis, because it's like, you say, well, there's lots of jokes, lots of fun, and then there's lots of seriousness. I think what allows it all to work is, it may be lighthearted, it may be serious, it may be funny, it may be sad, it's all real. Even this little joke of Edmund's is, it's like, well, what more realistic, you know, people, we're always forgetting things, I am, and it's like, oh yeah, that would happen to me. I would go into a new world and I'd leave something there. It's
right.
Like, yeah, I'd forget, I'd like, where did I leave? Oh, I left it in this magic
world. Right, just like,
it's like
the,
this,
words of sleeping,
it's humorous.
The words of sleeping out of doors is you wake up dreadfully early. Just little bits like that that make it real.
Yeah.
And the fact that he ends on
all,
that.
It's all real, and even like the pigs, it's funny, it's kind of weird, but in a sense, he just kind of tells it like, yeah, this, okay, so they turn into pigs.
Right.
And in fact, he doesn't even say they turn into pigs. He just says, no one ever knew what happened to the boys. But there are some very nice little pigs that are running around.
Right.
Kind of like, you know, real life. You can think about things in your life that happen that are funny, but it's real. They really happen.
Right.
Or you can look at things and they're sad, and that's real too.
Right.
I think that's what allows the book and all of this stuff to work.
That's a really good point. The way that Lewis is able to, you know, having those jokes, but not make it feel like, oh, it's comic relief to, like, break it up. You know, it's just like, no, it feels like it belongs in the story. These characters are real. So overall thoughts, Prince Caspian, like a lot of people, it is my least favorite book in this series. I like Prince Caspian because of what we were talking about. Just there's so many great little moments, and there's so many ideas I'm left kind of thinking about, kind of just banging around in my brain and my, you know, just even just emotionally. The idea of coming back to a world where you're looked at as this bedtime story figure, and people were debating if you ever existed, and the way it, because it sort of flips things around, makes you look at things from a different perspective. The children's emotions of, oh, it's so nice to be back. There's just a lot of things that kind of stick with me. And all the Narnia books have those things. The thing that Prince Caspian just doesn't have to the same extent is the story itself is not as it's not as well connected and doesn't seem quite as well thought out. It doesn't flow as well. I still love this book because of what it leaves me with, and leaves me a lot of things to remember. But it's just on a narrative level, I don't think it's probably the least good in the series.
I would agree on a lot of those points. I think. You know, I love. Why do I love Prince Caspian? Because I can say I do love the book, or really, really like it anyway. I love it for the things I walk away with, and the things I walk away with are the character development, the character moments. I think the reason that the book still succeeds as much as it does, and maybe if there's any other readers of fantasy out there, they could. Correct me, I can't think of any fantasy story that I've ever heard about or read about other than Prince Caspian where children go into a fairy tale land and what strikes them as odd is that it seems more like our world.
Ah,
one
interesting.
One of the really interesting twists that Lewis is only really able to do with Narnia, and only I think only Lewis could really pull off. I think that's part of why it still is a part of the series that no one would do away with.
Yeah. I think that kind of to bring us back to the very beginning of one of the first things we talked about at the beginning of part one, I think Prince Caspian, it doesn't stand alone as well as the other books in the series. Like I think not only do you really have to rely on The Witch and the Wardrobe first to appreciate Caspian, I also think you have to continue on and read Dawn Treader. You know, part of that is just what I said about Peter and Susan and Aslan's explanation. But I just think emotionally, Dawn Treader really closes a loop with Prince Caspian, and so we will continue on to the next one, which you have to.
Yeah, we will. And speaking of which, if any of you have specific things, whether you have just thoughts that you want to offer up, you can email glumpuddle@narniweb.com or rillian@narniweb.com, or if you have something specific you want us to address.
Especially things like, even like little things. Like, I'm sure that, we're going to talk, we'll have all kinds of things to say about Reapy Cheap. We'll talk about Dark Island. We'll talk about Dragon Island and all that. But maybe just like weird little random bits in the book.
Like the mermaids.
Yeah. Even just like little bits that maybe we might skim over. Like, no, talk about this. For some reason, this little bit caught my attention.
Yeah.
And so we want to hear from you.
Indeed. Well, cool. Thank you, my friend. Cool. And I will see you on the voyage.
That's right. Thanks a lot, Rillian. We will continue further up and further in.